My name's Hugh Kermode, and this is an extract from Death in Shanghai by M.J. Lee. Chapter 1. In the middle of Suchow Creek is a sandbank known by the locals as the Beach of Dead Babies. On a bright, cold Shanghai morning, there were no dead babies lying on it, just a dead blonde. Inspector Danilov stamped his feet on the cobblestones of the bank, trying to force some life into his cold toes. He pulled his old coat around his thin body and searched its pockets for his tobacco tin. Blowing some warm air on his fingers, he opened the tin and rolled a cigarette with one hand. The first breaths of smoke choked his lungs, producing a series of deep, barking coughs like the alarm cries of a deer. A spit of black tar filled his mouth, the remains of the opium he had smoked the night before. He spat it out and watched it land in the mud at the edge of the creek before it was swallowed by the lapping grey waters. His colleague, Charles Meeker, the district inspector from Hongqiu, walked to the middle of Zappu Bridge, scanning the area as if getting his bearings. At the centre of the bridge, Meeker located the position of the blonde stretched out on the sandbank. From a pocket, he produced a linen measuring tape and laid this along the stone parapet of the bridge. After an age of measuring, a smug smile spread across his pale face. "I believe it's one of yours. It's on your side," he shouted. Then he rolled up the measuring tape and put it back inside his jacket pocket, taking the opportunity to hitch his trousers over his large stomach. He strolled over to Danilov on the city side of the bridge.
"Floaters are always a nightmare. Hate 'em myself. Looks like they swum top to sail upstream and the body floated down. Enjoy it."
He tugged at his moustache.
"Another chance to enhance your reputation."
Danilov took a long drag of his cigarette, savouring the bitter tang of the tobacco.
"Thank you, Inspector Mika. Have you finished?"
He turned back, looking for his new constable in the large crowd that now lined the banks.
"Strachan, come here, will you?"
"It's Strawn," said Mika.
"The CH is silent, but you Russians wouldn't know anything about that, would you?"
The young detective ran up. "Yes, sir." He had a shock of black hair, an eager smile, and eyes that gave away he was half Chinese.
"Strachan," Inspector Danilov emphasised, "go down to the sandpans and check if anybody saw anything." "Good luck with that. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, just do evil. That's what this lot believe."
Mika mimed the actions of the three monkeys, ending with an expansive gesture that took in all the watching Chinese. Inspector Danilov ignored him.
"Go and check them anyway. Somebody must have seen something."
Strawn began to turn away.
"Don't forget to send a man to the pathologist. The morgue is just across Garden Bridge on the other side of the river. Let Dr. Fang know there's a body coming in."
"Yes, sir. Anything else, sir?" Strawn stood to attention, awaiting any further orders. He was new to the detective squad, and this was his first case.
"Hurry up. We haven't got all day," said Danilov. "The feet feed the wolf, as we say in Minsk."
Yes, sir. Right away."
"I'm off back to Hongqiu for a nice cuppa. Good luck with the floater, Danilov. Rather you than me, eh?"
With a long, pipe-stained chuckle, Mika twisted his moustache and walked back across the bridge to his own district. Danilov looked down once more at the muddy, murky water eddying around the foundations of the bridge, Inspector Mika and his jibes already forgotten. His eyes drifted across to the sandbank, where the body lay half-submerged, its arms stretched out to the sides, like Jesus on the cross, he thought. And then the image of a long-forgotten triptych came back to him, its central panel a Jesus with sharp ribs and blood pouring from a wound in his side. He smelt the rich fragrance of incense, a smell that was only found in the Orthodox churches of his youth. He lifted his nose to the wind and looked around him. A hawker had already set up his stall on the banks of the creek, taking advantage of the crowds that had come to see the body. The hawker was stirring his pot of charcoal and sweet potatoes with a wooden paddle. Each time he stirred, The unmistakable smell of incense filled the air. How strange, thought Danilov. How very strange. The body still lay there on the sandbank, only 30 yards from shore, but a whole lifetime away. The long blonde strands of hair, washed by the muddy waters, writhed in each ripple of the creek. The blondness contrasting vividly with the bleached greys of the sampans that lined the banks, tied up to each other, sometimes 3 deep. A child, its head as round as a football, ran to the prow of one of the boats where it was joined by a small dog, both fascinated by all the fuss. On his right leg, the child had a rope tied around his ankle. Danilov smiled to himself. Tied to a life on his boat for the next 40 years. Just like all of us. He heard Strawn run up and stand quietly behind him.
Time and tide wait for no man, the English are fond of saying, are they not?
I suppose so, sir.
Well then, let's get going. Our body is waiting for us, and the tide will change soon. Find the photographer. He should be around here somewhere.
Followed by a long line of people, Danilov walked through the crowd towards the sampan, like the Pied Piper leading a gaggle of curious children. He was watching from the crowd. He saw the pantomime performed by the tall detective with the absurd moustache, wearing a suit that was too small for him. The measuring, the sighting, the rushing around to achieve nothing. God, they were idiots. Why had he been forced to endure such morons all his life? But they kept him safe, he knew that. Their stupidity allowed him to hide among them, to hide in plain sight. In Shanghai, it was so easy to pretend to have a veneer of sophistication, a veil of normality. Here, surface was everything, shallowness exalted. Everybody had a secret. Everybody knew that somebody was hiding something. It just didn't matter. Well, he would make it matter. He would throw light on their shallowness, on their dark secrets. The city of shadows could not hide from him. Those flickering images that pretended to be real, concealing their evasions, lies, and dissembling. He would shine a light on them all. He would show them up for what they were. He had already started, but now it was time to really go to work. He caught the aroma of sweet potato on the air, an ugly vegetable with a beautiful core of sweetness within. A bit like Shanghai, he thought, but in reverse. Hi, I'm Hugh Kermode, and this is a chunk of Quantum, A Guide to the Perplexed, by Jim Al-Khalili, Radio 4's favourite engineer scientist. Chapter 2, Origins. Many books on popular science, even physics textbooks, tend to promulgate 2 myths concerning the origin of quantum mechanics. Of course, oversimplified accounts of the development of science are quite common, indeed necessary, in its teaching. Most of scientific progress is a messy and slow process, and it is only with hindsight and with an overall understanding of a theory or a phenomenon that its story can be told pedagogically instead of chronologically. This necessitates the distilling of certain events and personalities from the melee, often due to the neat packaging that results from the dishing out of Nobel Prizes. So what are these 2 myths? The first is the oversimplified and inaccurate account of the state of physics at the end of the 19th century. The story goes that scientists of the time felt they had most of physics wrapped up and explained, that all physical phenomena could be completely understood within a worldview supported by the twin pillars of Isaac Newton's mechanics and laws of motion and James Maxwell's newly completed electromagnetic theory. There just remained a handful of I's to dot and T's to cross. The second myth is that the German physicist Max Planck proposed a revolutionary new formula to describe an experimental result in the field of thermodynamics that could not be reproduced by the prevailing theory, and right away the quantum revolution was born. How it all began. While this book is not meant to be about the history of quantum mechanics or the personalities involved in its development, I will nevertheless tell in this chapter the story of how and why it all came about. Thus, while I do not wish to dwell for too long on the state of physics before quantum mechanics, it is interesting to try and pinpoint exactly when and how it all began. Regarding the first myth, the truth is that by the time the 19th century came to a close, there were so many issues to resolve and strange phenomena to explain that clearly something had to give. Physicists and chemists could not even agree on whether matter was ultimately composed of indivisible atoms or whether it was continuous and infinitely divisible. Nor could they decide on whether or not Newton's mechanics, equations that governed how macroscopic objects interacted and moved under the influence of forces, could be cast in terms of Maxwell's more fundamental theory of electromagnetism. And as if such fundamental questions were not enough, relatively new fields of physics, such as thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, were generating heated debate. On the experimental side, there were the unexplained phenomena of the photoelectric effect and blackbody radiation, both of which I will describe soon. And no one understood how to interpret the meaning of the patterns of line spectra in the light given off by certain elements. To add to all this, there was worldwide excitement generated by the newly discovered mysterious phenomena of X-rays, 1895, and radioactivity, 1896, not to mention the electron, 1897. Basically, physics was in a glorious mess. The second myth is that in late 1900, Max Planck revolutionized science by proposing that energy came in lumps called quanta, a notion he was forced to introduce in order to understand how warm objects radiated their heat, and quantum theory was instantly up and running. In truth, it was far less clear-cut than that. Indeed, some historians of science deny that Planck deserves any credit at all for discovering quantum theory. Unlike many other great revolutions in science, quantum mechanics was not due to the stroke of genius of one man. Newton had his eureka moment while contemplating an apple falling from a tree on his mother's farm and hit upon his famous law of gravitation, although it is likely that this event was apocryphal. And no one will deny credit to Darwin for his theory of evolution, nor to Einstein for his theories of relativity. But the discovery of quantum mechanics would have been simply too much for one person. Its development took 30 years, and the combined intellectual might of the world's greatest minds. Before I proceed, here is a good place to explain why I interchange between quantum theory and quantum mechanics. The former is used to refer to the state of affairs during the period 1900 to 1920, when everything was at the level of simple postulates and formulae that helped clarify some issues surrounding the nature of light and the structure of atoms. It wasn't until the 1920s that the real revolution took place, and a completely new worldview, quantum mechanics, replaced Newton's mechanics when it came to describing the underlying structure of the subatomic world. But back to the question of how it all got started, and let us be fair about this. Planck was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1918 with the citation, "In recognition of the services he rendered to the advancement of physics by his discovery of energy quanta." So while we will see how others such as Einstein and Boltzmann can also lay claim to laying the foundations of the original quantum theory, the key to all this is, after all, the concept of the quantum, something that was first introduced in Planck's simple formula. So what exactly did he do? Planck grew up in Munich and studied in Berlin, obtaining his PhD when he was only 21. 10 years later, he was a full professor of physics, but it was to be a further 11 years before he proposed his famous formula in a lecture to the Berlin Physical Society. He had come up with it in an ad hoc manner in order to solve a long-standing problem to do with the way some objects radiate heat, but he regarded it more as a neat mathematical trick than as containing a deep truth about nature itself. Planck's constant. According to Planck's formula, the energy of the smallest bundle of light of a given frequency, a single quantum, is equal to the frequency multiplied by a certain constant. This is known as Planck's constant of action. It has the symbol h, and, like the speed of light, c, is one of the universal constants of nature. The relation between energy and frequency is very simple. For instance, the frequency of violet light at one end of the visible spectrum is twice that of red light at the other end. And so a quantum of violet light has twice as much energy as a quantum of red light. Today, every student of physics learns about Planck's constant. In units of kilograms, meters, and seconds, it has the incredibly tiny value of 6.63 times 10 to the 34. And yet it is one of the most important numbers in science. Despite this number being so small, the crucial point is it is not zero. Otherwise, there would be no quantum behaviour. Very often, Planck's constant is combined with another fundamental constant of nature, pi. This number, as every school kid is taught, is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter, and crops up all the time in physics equations. In fact, the quantity h divided by 2 pi appears so often in quantum mechanics that a new symbol has been invented to describe it, called h-bar.